Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have a writer with me who I've wanted to speak to for a long time. But since for such a long time, I maintain the perhaps incorrect stance that I only do literary fiction and poetry on Bookworm. And Vivian Gornick, my guest, has been writing memoirs and works of, well, for lack of a better word, we'll call them literary criticism. I would say they're literary perception. And it was to my great pleasure when I read The Odd Woman in the City and realized that the book, now in paperback, that Vivian would be in Los Angeles. I said, stop being a fool, Michael. It's time when you read a memoir that moves you to look at it the way any other work of art that moves you. It has its significance. And then I went and read her book, The Situation and the Story, which talks about very pertinent issues of truth and reliability in memoir. What she says, essentially, is that the narrator of a memoir cannot be doubted, must be trusted. This is not a field for the unreliable narrator. The narrator must convince us of her authenticity. Why is that?
It's hard to explain. It's just I said it out of an accumulation of experience, both of reading and writing memoir, and realized the great memoirs were ones in which you felt that the writer was honestly trying to get to the bottom of the truth of the experience, was not playing games, was never going to pretend to be this or to know that, when in fact they were not this and didn't know that. It was George Orwell's Shooting an Elephant, actually, which I read when I was young and then taught many times, which made me realize what he was doing and that the power of it lay in his development of George Orwell, quote unquote, a murderous truth speaker. In that book, he hates everybody. it's equal opportunity. He hates the Raj, you know what the book, it's written in 1936. He's a policeman in Burma. He hates the British Raj, and he also hates the priests, and he hates the people in the street. They all hate each other, and he makes you aware of the meaning of everybody being locked out of civilization by this extraordinarily honest-sounding voice. And then you realize that what he's doing is, in the only way that a memoirist can, is he's shedding light on the circumstance just by struggling to be a truth-speaking narrator.
So when you wrote your memoir called Fierce Attachments, you wrote about your mother, and mm-hmm. you wrote about her with all the love and hatred of which you're capable, yes?
Right.
And it couldn't be otherwise.
No.
A memoir that doesn't tell the truth or pretends that the truth is readily available.
Right.
Is right. Making an error, and the first step mm-hmm. is to find the narrator. You say the narrator right. is the story.
Yes.
Tell me what that means.
Well, in my belief, when you write a memoir, you are searching to shape a piece of experience that by definition is a piece of self-discovery. That is the whole aim of the memoir, in the course of which the memoirist must engage with the world beyond oneself. In other words, as I would always teach my students, your feelings are not a subject. You use your feelings in order to engage with a subject. In that act, the voice of the narrator that is doing the engaging to a large extent becomes the story that is being told. I don't really know why or how else to express it, but that is what I felt, as opposed to a piece of fiction or even a poem in which the narrator is not. The narrator of a novel, for instance, can be completely unreliable. There's another agenda at work. There is a whole cast of characters who will pit themselves against each other in order to tell what the writer has come to say. But in a memoir, the narrator, who's clearly the writer, has only oneself to pit against oneself. And it's in that crux that the drama takes place. It does become the story that is being told.
Vivian Gornick is the author of The Odd Woman in the City. When I was reading the book, I came upon a section that moved me very deeply, and I think it may move you as well. Many of us come upon that moment when we realize that we've been daydreaming for most of our lives, and we don't know how to stop. And this is Vivian Gornick reading what I take to be the awakening section of her new book in paperback, The Odd Woman in the City. Vivian Gornick.
For many years, I walked 6 miles a day. I walked to clear my head, experience street life, dispel afternoon depression. During those walks, I daydreamed incessantly. Sometimes I daydreamed the past, idealizing remembered moments of love or praise, but mostly I daydreamed the future, the tomorrow in which I would write a book of enduring value, meet the companion of my life, become the woman of character I had yet to become. Ah, that tomorrow, how wonderfully its energetic projections got me through innumerable days of wasteful passivity. Then, just as I was turning 60, an unusual development sent this cozy setup into a tailspin. That spring, I was teaching in Arizona and walking daily along a road at the edge of the town, taking new pleasure in the physical beauty that surrounded me, the mountains, the desert, the clarity of light, but as usual, running a movie in my head. One afternoon in April, right in the middle of the film, a kind of visual static, something like the static on a television screen, cut across my inner field of vision. The story began literally to break up before my eyes, and then it actually terminated itself. At the same time, an acrid taste began to fill my mouth, and deep within, I felt myself shrinking from I knew not what. The entire incident was so strange, so baffling, that it mystified rather than alarmed me, and I thought to myself, an aberrant occurrence, expect no repeats. But the next day, exactly the same thing happened. There I was, walking along the blacktopped road, another movie underway in my head, when again, the story short-circuited itself. The acrid taste filled my mouth, and again I felt myself blanching before some unnameable anxiety. When on the third day the entire process repeated itself, it became clear that a sea change was in progress. Before long, I became sufficiently gun-shy. I had begun to dread the nastiness in my mouth, to want to suppress the daydreaming, and lo and behold, it turned out that I could. Now, no sooner did the images start to form in my head than I found myself able to wipe them clean before they could take hold. It was then that the really strange and interesting thing happened. A vast emptiness began to open up behind my eyes as I went about my daily business. The daydreaming, it seemed, had occupied more space than I'd ever imagined. It was as though the majority of my waking time had routinely been taken up with fantasizing, only a narrow portion of consciousness concentrated on the here and now. Days passed, then weeks and months in which I dreaded waking into my own troubled head. I thought often in those days of Virginia Woolf's phrase, moments of being, because I wasn't having any. Then, seemingly from one day to the next, I became aware, after one of my street encounters, that the vacancy within was stirring with movement. A week later, another encounter left me feeling curiously enlivened. It was the third one that did it. A hilarious exchange had taken place between me and a pizza delivery man, and sentences from it now started repeating themselves in my head as I walked on, making me laugh each time anew and each time with yet deeper satisfaction. Energy, coarse and rich, began to swell inside the cavity of my chest. Time quickened, the air glowed, the colors of the day grew vivid, my mouth felt fresh. A surprising tenderness pressed against my heart with such strength it seemed very nearly like joy, and with unexpected sharpness I became alert, not to the meaning, but to the astonishment of human existence. It was there on the street, I realized, that I was filling my skin, occupying the present.
Vivian Gornick, reading what I think is the transition section, the awakening section of The Odd Woman in the City. And now I have to ask the question that everyone is asking. What is an odd woman?
Oh, The Odd Woman, the title of The Odd Woman is taken from a book called The Odd Women by George Gissing, who was a great Victorian novelist who wrote one of the great feminist novels of all times called The Odd Women. And the reason I use it is that, to back up a little bit, the women's movement, the modern women's movement, begins with the French Revolution, with Mary Wollstonecraft and the Vindication of the Rights of Women. And every 50 years after that, it raises its ugly little head. We start all over again. And each time around, we are called something else. We're called new women, free women, liberated women.
Emancipated women.
Yes. But we're not emancipated, and we never were. And Gissing, I feel, nailed it by calling us the odd women, by which he meant those women who could not make their peace with the world as it was. And when I read The Odd Women the first time around, I felt that I was reading my generation incarnate. I felt he really, in every way, he nailed us. And he taught me from that book that the real struggle of life is the one in which we all fall into the gap between theory and practice. Hence the odd woman. I am the odd woman. By the way, I'd like to say now that all the things that I reveal, quote unquote, about myself, but it's all in service to my rapture with the streets of New York City. If it wasn't for that, if that wasn't the spine of the book, if I wasn't out in the street like a classic flaneur looking for salvation, restoration, revitalization from all of these things, if that's what I do, and New York has been my salvation in the sense that it always restores me to a sense of common humanity.
And so what we see in this book is an amalgam. Something the reader has to put together, him or herself, of bus riders who are truculent, subway riders, people begging on the street corners. Mm-hmm. Vivian Gornick says, I will talk to anyone who will talk to me.
Right.
And although as a child of the left, I do not believe in begging, a beggar is speaking to me, and I say, and this is an encounter, I say, when are you going to give this up?
Right.
You've been begging on my street corner between my apartment and the subway stop for more than 2 years. And what does he say?
I'll decide when the vacation is over. Gregory. I call him Arthur, I think, in the book. Yeah. Yes, yes, he actually said that. Yes, they're a marvelous population.
And it's kind of a marvelous thing to see the author of the memoir turning outside the subject of the self to see what is there in the city to be seen.
Right.
And this is reflected. You see, this book has a lot of self-reflection.
Well, thank you so much.
By a woman who's in an old age home. She had been a novelist.
Yeah.
And she's very dispirited. The people there, she says, the only time I have useful, meaningful, rich conversation is when I'm talking to you, Vivian, or when I'm reading.
Anyone like, that's right.
But before she knows it, her abilities as a novelist, she was at one time a well-known and admired novelist, whatever her actual skills, she discovers that the older people around her are fascinating and that they awaken her eye as a novelist.
Right.
That we all, the book is saying, we've got to come back to life. We owe it to ourselves not to hide into the depression that won't let us out of bed.
Right. Well, she is a woman who valued consciousness above all. And when she found herself deprived of it in this way, of living in an old age home where she really had nobody to talk to, all she ever experienced was chatter until people like me came to visit her. She nevertheless pulled herself together because she was a woman of character. And as painful as it was for me to watch, she invested all her consciousness in observing and responding to the people around her who gave her nothing back. That was what was so impressive.
Except that gradually, as she pays them attention,
yes,
and as they realize that her attention is a vital commodity.
Yes.
Her attention is the attention of good judgment and accuracy. They will ask her to help them solve problems that only she can solve because she cares enough about the small details, which is what a novelist does.
Right. In that sense, the book is like a nest of Chinese boxes, you know. I become her. She's a very, you know, she reflects on me, and many others do too.
And you describe her with a beautiful image. Every once in a while, there'll be a summative image in this book. The woman is at the center of a circle. Mm. Its radii join to this circumference.
Like the spokes of a wheel.
And every time someone comes to visit, this radius lights up. So she's at the center, in fact. Yeah. Of a good world, and that world is the world of shared consciousness.
Yeah. Now, you know why I came up with that image? I had to find an ending that would connect what was happening there to the city. I had to make an ending that would remind, there's not one section in which I'm not reminding the reader of New York and of what's happening on the streets. And so I came up with that image, and I'm very glad I did.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Vivian Gornick about her memoir, The Odd Woman in the City. We'll continue after this short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Vivian Gornick about her latest book, now in paperback, The Odd Woman in the City, her story of being an independent woman living on the odds and ends of urban relationships. One of the things that's, I think, new in this book is the brevity of the observations. I'm going to read a tiny one. I ran into Gerald in Midtown, an ex-lover.
Husband.
husband. Oh, I didn't know.
Who's my husband?
You're careful to keep this concealed. Yeah. You used me, he cried. Not nearly well enough, I said. He stood there looking at me, memory clouding his eyes. What was all that about, anyway? He asked wearily. Sweetheart, I said, it could never have worked. I was headed for where I am now. What is it with you, he countered. Why did you make such a holocaust with us? Oy, is that Jewish? And a bukernisht. Yeah. Why did you keep making scenes until all I had left was the taste in my mouth of your unholy dissatisfaction? I felt my eyes turning inward toward that thick, white opacity that surrounds my heart when it comes to erotic love.
Oh, did I write that?
I can't do men, I said. What the hell does that mean, he said. I'm not sure. When will you be sure? I don't know. So what do you do in the meantime? Take notes. And these are the notes.
Yes, these are the notes.
These are the notes that are taken
right.
In the face of an unanswerable question.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout this book, people are asking you, much to your dismay, what do you mean by that?
Right.
It's the question you say you hate most.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Yet it is the question you're asking of the world. What do you mean by that? What are you asking me from? What can I bring that I have not yet brought? What is unlocatable in me that I still need to find? Now, you're 80 years old.
I am.
Do you believe that you can still find it?
I don't think I phrase it that way anymore. I think what I concentrate on now is becoming more of a mensch. I don't propose, and I think this in a large and a small way at the same time. Sometimes it gets so frantic because the world imposes itself so much on us now, and I feel as frantic and as anxiety-ridden about it as everybody else I know. I didn't used to, but I'm aware of politics all the time now. And then I get frantic because I'm not doing anything. I'm not in a position of power. I'm not a journalist. I'm not explaining anything. I'm not, you know, I'm none of those things. And then I remember something I once read, someone who said, if you're not in public service and if you're not, you know, like a missionary, if you're not working actively, your obligation is to be the best that you can be and to do your work and be the best person that you can be. That is your obligation. And when I remember that, I'm more at peace than ever. And I take that as my task. It is my task in the world to write better and better, to think better and better, and above all, to act better and better. I know how sappy that might sound, but I mean it. So I don't feel bewildered. And in fact, after I wrote this book, I felt less of a stranger to myself than I ever have. I don't know how else to put it.
I think that's a marvelous way of putting it.
I'll ask
the infuriating question.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Is it that you know the other person within you that you're in dialogue with?
I guess I feel that having written that, that I'm more rather than less at one with my writing self and with the person inside this body and living in the world and being with the people that I interact with.
Is it pleasing or difficult to hear that I think this is your very best book? I've read four others.
I'm pleased, very pleased, and grateful. Your interpretation is very generous, and it makes me happy.
I think that somehow that recognition of the role in life of the daydream and that when you try essentially to slap yourself whenever you catch yourself, daydreaming leaves you with a lot of time to slap.
Yes, it's remarkable how, yes, it is. It's how much more present I feel myself since that time, and it's been a long time now, and how successful, the fact that I've been so successful at sort of stopping, you know, the daydreaming in this wrong way, makes me realize that some large part of the psyche must always have wanted to stop, you know, and
yes,
wanted to be the here, right now, right here.
But this book, which is so based upon paradox, you see, the dreams and the daydreams are the children of city life.
Mm.
A place where fame and class,
yes,
and the possibility tomorrow,
yeah,
of being discovered to be
right,
the one always dreamt of.
The hero
so,
of one's own life.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's the city is both the hero and the villain in this book. I know you
can't
leave.
There are many ways to be a New Yorker. One is to see yourself as a figure on that landscape of glamour and posterity and fun and action and at a high level, politically or in government or in anything, in all the arts and all, you know, to become a big time person. The other has always been every great city, the urban rather than the urbane, the urban person tramping the streets of the city. And the working class has been absolutely key to this. The children, you remember all those movies of Rossellini's. I even used that at one point, those post-war, Second World War, post-war Italian movies.
With those orphan boys with
urchins,
those brown eyes.
Yeah. And all those teenagers and young people, figures like Sophia Loren, I Want Mine, you know, coming up out of the rubble of Naples and tramping the streets of those cities, making them their own, as indeed we did, making them their own by knowing every section of the city.
I've been talking with Vivian Gornick, author of The Odd Woman in the City, a memoir published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux, now available in paperback. Thank you, you toughie, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Odd Woman and the City at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.